Thank you for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be here and share with you some ideas that, in some sense, draw together two of my streams of research. I've done a bunch of articles on populism, which is always a hot topic, you know, on a chilly day, a hot topic in the study of Latin America, a lot of debates on that. I've also done some work on social policy, so today's talk kind of draws those two streams of my research together. And what I'm presenting is, in some sense, I've tried to leave this topic of populism behind, but it's hard to get away from it when you have new populists emerging, like Hugo Chavez, and, you know, you attempted to try to say something about it. But this is not my current sort of real core focus of my research anymore. I'm doing a book project on waves of democratic contention in Europe and Latin America. So what I'm presenting today is more an essay that I wrote, kind of finishing up earlier stuff, and hopefully it's a little provocative, you know, since it involves populism, probably. But it also involves social policy. And social policy, of course, in Latin America is always an acute topic because Latin America is the region that holds the world record for social inequality. And so the question is, what could be done about this? How could one address this surprisingly large-scale poverty, deep social inequality in Latin America? When you look at that topic from a global perspective, the best strategy that has been developed in the world for providing social protection on an economically sustainable basis is European social democracy. I'm from Europe, so I like saying that. But of course, you think of European social democracy and you think immediately that's not going to work very easily in Latin America for a number of reasons. One is just the base of economic mass prosperity that doesn't exist. But also, social democracy is a strategy that is difficult to apply in the region of underdeveloped countries. One is social inequality, poverty create urgent needs. Social democracy in Europe took decades and decades and decades to build a welfare state. And the question is there enough patience to go that kind of route in Latin America? Think, for example, Brazil. So Brazil had, under President Cardoso, a so-called self-called social democratic party in government. They did some interesting reforms in the areas of education and health. They come up for re-election, they lose. Despite the relatively good performance, they lose in 2002 to a self-styled socialist who, coming to power, did fewer reforms in those areas. But they lost because there just wasn't the patience to build up slowly. The other even more important obstacle is that social democracy has organizational preconditions. In many ways, it requires comparatively well-organized political parties, broad-based interest associations that in many Latin American countries don't exist. They exist in a few countries, Chile, Costa Rica, Uruguay, maybe sort of slowly forming Brazil. In many other countries, they don't exist. And so for that reason, those groups and parties that have been inspired by social democracy haven't found it easy to really address poverty, inequality in a way that is also politically very viable. It doesn't work out that way. That, of course, raises the question whether there's another strategy that could address these urgent, acute social problems in a more promising fashion. And given that social democracy, one reason why it doesn't work is the lack of organization, then the question is, could it be just political agency, leadership? So you don't have the organization, you don't have the preconditions, just use political will and leadership. And in many ways, in Latin America, the prototype of leadership, of kind of unbounded agency, is populism. Personalistic leaders who essentially emerge where there aren't strong organizations who increase their power, increase their autonomy above and beyond organizations, who push aside institutional constraints to get things done. And so the question for tonight is, can populism in Latin America serve as a strategy for addressing poverty and inequality in a way that is more promising, that is politically more sustainable than that imitation of social democracy that doesn't work very well in Latin America? So that's what I want to address today. Can populism essentially fill the reform deficit that the difficulties that social democracy faces leave open? Now, when you think about populism, the immediate question is, how do you understand populism? How do you define it? Because it's a concept, it's a term that has been used in such different ways, lots of conceptual debates about this. historically speaking, there was in some sense a fairly easy answer to my question, because in many ways social policy was incorporated in the old classical definitions of populism. When you think of kind of the classical populists of Latin America, Juan Perón and Getulio Vargas, the literature that focused on those characters essentially defined populism in a multidimensional, complex way, saying you have political leadership, charismatic leadership, you have those leaders are populist if they also pursue certain types of economic and social policies, kind of nationalist, inward-looking, state interventionist economic policies, and mildly redistributive, generous social policies. And that package, where that package exists, that's a populist. So if that definition works, you have answered my question, we can all go to the reception outside, because then populism does lead to generous social policy, and that is sort of stipulated by definition. But that old definition of populism that constructed a whole package, a style of political leadership, a type of economic policy, a type of social policy, has come under attack, partly for a number of theoretical reasons, but also partly because in Latin American reality, new types of leaders emerged that made it harder to use this old concept of populism. And one type of political leader that emerged in the 1990s is what a number of people, including myself, called neoliberal populists, like Fujimori, like Menem. So you have like Collor in Brazil. They acted in a political way with a political strategy that was very similar to the classical populists. You know, Collor, for example, called his followers descamisados, just like Perón did. And it was the same unorganized followership. It was the same personalistic leadership. They invoked the old examples. Politically speaking, just looked like the old characters. But in the economic and social policies, it was very different, because they didn't do inward-oriented, nationalist, state interventionist economic policy. They did neoliberalism, the opposite. They dismantled the type of economic policy that the old classical populists had constructed in the opposite direction. In the social policy, often, for example, Fujimori, when he came to office and did his Fujimori shock neoliberal adjustment, he didn't care about social policy at all. Nothing generous, just brutal. So what that led to, a number of people questioning whether that old comprehensive package with which we define populism really works very well. And those people, including myself, have advocated defining populism in a purely political perspective, emphasize the political aspects. So populism as a political strategy. We have a personalistic leader who tries to reach a comparatively unorganized mass of heterogeneous followers in a quasi-direct way, bypassing, going beyond intermediary institutions. That means by strong institutionalized political parties, but direct, like via TV. Hi, here I am, and I'm your friend, and I get into your household. And not because I'm mediated by parties and organizations, but this direct relationship between a personalistic leader who has plebiscitarian support from this sort of fluid mass of people. And that's the concept of populism that I'm using here and that I'm applying. That, of course, doesn't include social policy. And you see that populists, who we define in that way, some of them have general social policies, others have no social policies. You know, think, for example, of right-wing populists in Europe. They don't care about social policy. They have other slogans with which they try to get support, like anti-immigration. I said Fujimori initially didn't pursue much social policy. And so then the question of today, what does populism mean for social policy, is actually a research question, not just a definitional kind of stipulation. And what I want to do today is think about what the political characteristics of populism mean for social policy, or from those political characteristics we can derive some ideas and then see how it works out in the social policies that populist presidents pursue. So that's essentially what I'm going to do. Now, when you think of these political characteristics, what that means is a political leader is personalistic, has this mass support, but it's not organized, it's not institutionalized. And especially the more recent populists in many ways have an anti-organizational, anti-institutional bent. So how do they maintain this support? One way how they try to maintain support is that when they have financial resources and when they operate in a region like Latin America where there are pressing social needs, they try to enact social policies. And so Fujimori didn't do it in the beginning because he didn't have the money. As soon as Fujimori had money from 1993 onward, even Fujimori created social programs. And the question is, what types of social programs do they create? And what are the advantages that populism, that political strategy brings for social policy? And what are the disadvantages? And my central point is this, that populism has some advantages. Because populist leaders, they concentrate a good amount of power. They try to be autonomous. They try to get rid of checks and balances. So populism means capacity for agency, for action. You can do things. So one thing, for example, that populist leaders can do is they can create social policy programs quickly. They can essentially pull them out of their hat and create it quickly. And they can, when they have the resources, create fairly massive social programs. Fujimori did it, as we'll see. Chavez did it, as we'll see. What we also see is that these social programs are comparatively targeted towards the poorest sectors of the population. I also try to explain out the political logic of these populists. That's also in many ways an advantage because these are the most needy sectors. But on the other hand, that very unbounded agency, that very kind of act of willing, of just creating social programs, means that they're often done in a rush, they're often done with haste, they're not very well designed, they're not very well organized, they're not very well implemented and administered, and they're not based on solid financial base. And so populists can act quickly, but they often don't create programs that really have a lot of impact and effect in the medium and long run, and that are questionable sustainability in financial and institutional terms. So that's essentially the points that I'm going to try to make. Now, if you talk about populism, what I want to do is I want to look at populism in general, not only at certain versions, because you see that Latin American populism has kind of switched or moved the sort of swing of the pendulum along the ideological spectrum. The classical populists, Perón, Vargas, were kind of center-left. The neoliberal populists were right-wingers in many ways. Hugo Chavez is a left-winger. And so I don't want to just look at one experience because then it's populism, that's just the right-wingers or the left-wingers. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to highlight mainly two experiences, one of a neoliberal populist, Fujimori in the 1990s, a right-winger, and then Hugo Chavez, a left-winger, radical populist nowadays who is a left-winger. And so if you can find common characteristics in the social policies that these presidents have enacted, then it wouldn't be right or left or neoliberal or radical, but populism as such. Now, when you talk about implementation problems, bad administration, corruption, and whatnot, everybody says, that's not distinctive for populism, it's just Latin America. So we need to have a reasonable base of reference or comparison. And for that purpose, I'm going to compare the social policies that these two populists enacted with a couple of governments or governing coalitions that operated in those countries that have tried to follow a more social democratic inspired strategy in Latin America. And that was essentially Fernando Henrique Cardoso in Brazil and Lula da Silva in Brazil. So two governments that have tried, you know, more or less to go the gradual route, the slow route, and the center-left coalition in Chile, the Concertación, that was voted out of office last year. So those are the base of comparison. So I'm trying to emphasize similarities among the two populists and then see how that compares with those two more kind of gradual reformist types of governments. So when you look at that, you see that populism has advantages. They can act quickly. Like Fujimori, in the beginning, he had very little cash, he had no resources, he was very hard-pressed, he didn't do very much about social policy at all. From 1993 onward, he acted quickly to institute social policy programs. For example, he created a fund for social investment that got a surprising amount of resources. He created a fund that would build schools. He suddenly created a number of social programs, basic health programs, education programs. And they did it comparatively quickly. Hugo Chavez is famous. In 2003, partly because the oil price went up, he suddenly created these, he calls it misiones, missions, that are essentially social policy programs. A number of programs created fairly quickly that cover millions of people, that get billions of dollars. And populists can do that because they have this concentrated power, they have this autonomy, there aren't checks and balances, you know, there isn't like Congress, there's no, you can't do that because Fujimori had closed Congress and Chavez has occupied Congress and he says, you know, whatever they say, Comandante, yes, we're going to do it, boom. So that's an advantage, right? I mean, you face acute, urgent social problems, people have real needs, and whoop, you can do something quickly. The more reformist, gradual governments, they go way more slowly. You know, for example, Fernando Henrique Cardoso created a family health program that was decided in 1993, 94. It was not until 1998 that finally that kind of got underway and started to cover more and more people. And it took years and years until that had reached like coverage of half of the target population. Lula da Silva with this family grant program, Bolsa Familia, that people talked about, that was also enacted fairly gradually. Chile had a social investment fund, FOSIS, somewhat similar to Fujimori's, but it was always comparatively small, comparatively slow. When in Chile, President Lagos made a health program, it was enacted gradually. He made a health insurance program that would cover everybody in the Chilean health sector. And it was initially introduced for a few basic health problems, and a few more were added. Gradual creation, gradual implementation, much slower. And that's in many ways a disadvantage, because that means that a lot of people with urgent social problems don't get services, don't get benefits for quite a while. And so one of the advantages of populism is speed and kind of massive move to attack these problems. Another advantage is that these populists tend to focus disproportionately on poorer sectors of the population. Fujimori did that very clearly as a result of the neoliberal principle of targeting. Neoliberal social policy says the middle class can pay for social services and insurance in the market. The state should focus on the poorer sectors of the population who can't do that kind of thing. So Fujimori, for a while at least, acting like a neoliberal, said that's what we're going to do. So he created a basic health program, he created a basic education program. His social investment fund was focused on poorer sectors of the population, people living in the squatter settlements of Lima, people living in the rural hinterlands. And Fujimori partly delivered that himself. He took out 3-4 days out of his agenda and went around in a helicopter and kind of started things, visiting places that no Peruvian president ever visited before. Poor, backward, neglected. Here was the populist who finally tried to incorporate these people in some way. Hugo Chavez has also focused a lot of the social policy programs on poorer sectors of the population who are in many ways seen as his core constituents. You know, like these popular stores where everybody can go shopping, Mercal. They're in the poorer barrios of Caracas. They're not in the urbanizaciones, the middle-class neighborhoods. A lot of the other programs are effectively or through self-targeting. They mainly benefit poorer sectors of the population. That is in many ways a result of the political logic of populism, because populists have to maintain their mass support. They don't have that much of an organizational followership, people who are tied to them out of long-lasting loyalty. They have to kind of maintain their comparatively fickle, fluid mass base. And when you think of it from the effort of gaining support, poor people are especially promising targets for populists because, first, they don't tend to be members of like trade unions that often are more for the lower middle class or working class, but not the real excluded poor people. And the other thing is, and neoliberals agree with that too, is the votes of poor people are cheap. You know, you give people a comparatively small benefit, you can get their loyalty, they are rewarding you in the voting booth much more easily than if you try to provide benefits to middle-class people. And so the political logic of populism in many ways means that they have tried to disproportionately target these poorest sectors of the population. Now, there are reformist governments. The Concertos in Chile, Lula in Brazil, Cardoso in Brazil, they also had special programs for the poorest sectors of the population. Like that family grant program, Bolsa Familia, that's famously targeted at the poorest of the poor, the bottom 25% of the population. But it doesn't get that much money. Everyone expects, oh, Bolsa Familia, you know, 45 million people are covered. It's funded for 0.5% of GDP. That is not very much. The Brazilian pension system for people who used to work for the state, as state employees or state workers, eats up 5% of GDP. And so you see the disproportion. You know, they first take care, and the Brazilian Workers' Party has one of its core constituencies among people who work for the state. 5% of GDP for them, and then 0.5% for the millions and millions of people who are the poorest. And we're like, oh my God, this is brilliant. You know, Bolsa Família, how so big? If you look at the money, in comparative terms, they do way more for other sectors of the population. It was similar in the Chilean case. In the Chilean case, Pinochet had targeted very kind of brutally on the poorest of the poor. When the center-left coalition came to office, they in many ways broadened their sectors that were benefited by the state. They didn't only want to cover the bottom 20-30% of the population, but they extended that. And so in some sense, in relative terms, they shifted the focus, they gave benefits, they included those people who were kind of in the middle of the income pyramid, sort of pulling away from, in relative terms at least, from the poorest of the poor. And so you see in that respect also, populists in some sense have an advantage. They really focus on those who are the most needy. So those are the advantages, and you see that it follows from the political logic of populism, it follows from the power, the agency that populist leaders have, it follows from their strategy for targeting certain sectors that seem to be especially promising, especially winnable as supporters. But what I argue is that in many ways the disadvantages of populism outweigh those advantages, because there are a number of problems that also emerge from the very political logic of populism and that create problems. The very speed with which populists proceed often means that these programs are done in a very hasty, very rash kind of way. They're not very well designed, they're not very well planned, they're done in a rush. And they also, since that rush is driven often by pretty instrumental political purposes, they tend to be quite politicized. You see that from when these populist leaders quickly created these types of programs, Fujimori from 1990 to 1992 was brutal, just adjustment, didn't do very much at all. Then, I'm coming up for re-election in 1995. Now I've been brutal for 2 or 3 years, what can I do to get re-elected? Boom, let's do some social programs. So, wow. He created quickly these social programs. Quickly and clearly with a political goal in mind. Chavez himself, he's a very honest person. He said it in some of his speeches. You know, I was facing this recall referendum. The opposition in 2003 was calling for a recall referendum. My popularity ratings were at the bottom. So, you know, what I thought is, well, let's create this Misiones and make sure that people are going to vote for me. So there was a very transparent political purpose behind creating these things and creating them quickly. Because he started creating them in 2003, in 2004, sort of dragged his feet on that recall referendum. Then finally in 2004, that recall referendum came up, and he, partly based on the support that he gained as a result of these social programs, won that. So the speed and the political motivation can create problems. For example, design flaws. You know, you do things quickly, but you don't really think it through. You don't have a clear plan. What you're going to do. And you see that, like Fujimori, for example. Fujimori in 2004 created health programs, but he created two health programs that had a contradictory logic. One was a community self-management project, kind of decentralized, let the community do it. The other one was a centralized targeting the poor program, and people like, well, you know, are you going to do it centralized or decentralized? Two things at the same time don't work very well. Fujimori, I don't care, let's just do it. Fujimori, you know, education. So education is very important. What does Fujimori do? He builds schools. Why? One reason is you build a school, then you fly in a helicopter and they say, hey, people of so-and-so, I've given you a school. Let's cut the ribbon, you know, let's take a bunch of pictures. Let me fly back. Let me fly away with my helicopter. Is there a teacher? Are there textbooks? Is the teacher showing up? Is there education? Well, that's not my problem. I opened that school and built that school. Fukimori created a special health insurance for public school kids. You know, public school kids, they are poor, this is nice and whatnot. That was also a measure like, wow, you know, Fukimori, he included so and so many millions of public school kids into health insurance. That was in many ways, the health experts went like, school kids, you know, from like age 6 to 18, they don't tend to get sick. You have to focus on the mothers and the infants. That's where the problem is. School kids, that's just essentially a political measure to say, hi, I included 5 million Peruvians into health insurance. You know, nobody's ever going to get sick. I have to pay, but, you know, I did this program. So you see sort of the, you know, doing something that wasn't a priority. The health experts were like, why would you ever want to do this? Why didn't you talk to us before you created that? But it was sort of politically driven in that sense. Chavez's creation of these missions was also not based on an overarching plan, but just like, oh, the recall referendum is coming up. Let's do a ton of different things at the same time. And one of the issues and design problems that you see with Chavez's missions is that there's a good amount of politicization going on. Politicization in the sense first that according to a number of reports, opposition supporters don't get the benefits and Chavez supporters do get the benefits. You know, like for the recall referendum, you had to sign up, you had to sign your name and your ID card. So they had the information. Who is supporting the recall referendum? Well, one of the Chavez supporters put it on the web. Everybody could look up. You know, let's see who the opposition people are. So you come up for a benefit. Oh, let's see where the opposition. Oh, no benefit for you. And so these lists, the information of who was an opposition supporter or not, was according to a number of reports used to exclude some and include others. Much more important was self-selection in many ways. Because a lot of these missions are very politicized. You walk into the office and it's not like, you know, this is the education office, but there's Chavez here and Chavez's grandmother there, picture, and there's, you know, Chavez again and the young Chavez and Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, and you're like, whoa, if you're an opposition supporter, they're like, oh, I don't think this is for me. The Chavistas walk in and claim the benefits. And so you see a good amount of political selectivity. It's not for everybody as a social entitlement based on citizenship, but it's politically skewed based on active exclusion or more common this kind of self-exclusion. That also means, of course, that one of the kind of promises of the Chavez approach is participatory, autonomous participation from the base. But if this is more politicized, then it's not autonomous from the base because then you have to be kind of nice to get the benefits. Fukimori's programs were also politicized. I mean, people did statistical analysis where you can see that allocation of benefits was driven by political criteria. Similar people have done, Kirk Hawkins and Guillermo Rosas did a study of Chavez's missions and the politicization. And what you see, which is very interesting, is so Chavez's social programs have two types. One is these stores where everybody can go shopping. That's a public good. You can't easily say, wait a minute, you know, did you sign the recall referendum? You can't buy here. You let everybody in. So those stores where you can't easily exclude opposition supporters, they tend to be disproportionately in the core Chavista districts. We have like 80% Chavistas. So, they, you know, the 15-20% non-Chavistas, they walk in, no big deal. Those types of social benefits that you can allocate individually, like school scholarships, those tend to be disproportionately given to districts that are kind of swing in the middle, because they can say, well, you know, let's look, you know, did you sign the recall referendum? Oh, sorry, the scholarships have run out. You didn't sign, you get one. And so you can infer from the allocation, you know, that this is not driven by social need, but that this is driven, at least in part, by political considerations. So that's kind of an issue of design flaws, how you create these things. what kind of purposes is it really addressed as social problems meant as an entitlement, as a right, or is it politicized? Is it driven by political considerations and partly done in a comparatively bad way? What you also see is in, the non-populist governments, there's politicization there too, but not as much. And if you don't trust me, trust my wife. She's doing a study, Wendy Hunter at UT. She's doing a study of Bolsa Familia, the Lula program of the family grant, this conditional cash transfer. And so she did research in poor neighbors of Recife in the interior of Bahia, essentially asking, you know, who do you owe this to and what do you have to do and is this a favor? And what people say is that it's not very politicized, that people really have a sense of entitlement, that these conditional cash transfers, when you are on the roll, you get the benefit automatically, you bypass local intermediaries, and so you get it much more as a, you know, based on need. And whether you are entitled, whether you fulfill the requirements, is checked fairly consistently. Similar in the Chilean case. In the Chilean case, partly because the Confederación faced a very vigilant opposition, so there's always some level of, you know, politicization and clientelism, but comparatively little, partly because they wouldn't have gotten away with it, you know, using large-scale politicization. And so the more reform-oriented non-populist governments, they don't have that level of politicization. Also, when they design their social programs, they roll them out gradually. They design them much more carefully, much more systematically than these populist initiatives that within a few weeks and months you create these social programs, kind of out of pull them out of the hat. So I told you, like the family health program of the Cardoso government in Brazil, that was actually the second stage based on a community health agent program. And then they upgraded it, and they had study groups, and they had commissions, and they had pilot programs, and then they created, and then they sort of extended it to the rest of the country in a slow process that involved a good amount of consultation with experts and also with international financial institutions. So not, you know, quickly within a few weeks, but a very systematic process of designing these social programs. Similar in Chile. Chilean policymaking is comparatively technocratic. It has its disadvantages because people don't feel that much involved. But in terms of policy creation, policy design, and policy performance, it has brought about a comparatively good and high level of performance. So you see the contrast here in terms of design flaws, politicization between those two types of governments. You also see that in the implementation of policy, because social policy, a lot of people look at social policy creation and, oh, there's a new program. But in social policy, in many ways, the devil is in the implementation, because you're going to have a beautiful social program, but if it, you know, as I said before, if you build a school but there isn't a teacher and they don't have textbooks, it doesn't do very much good. And so what is very important is these social programs that are created, is there a base for kind of steady implementation? And that, once again, is much less the case in these populist types of governments. The number of implementation problems that you see with these populist types of governments and their social policies, based on the rush with which they roll out these programs. So you see that the speed means that there aren't often very clearly defined procedures, that these new social programs, they're not administered by established institutions, but they're often done more in the style of campaigns. You know, let's all get together, have a lot of willpower, and try to do something. So, but as a result of that, you don't have kind of very well-defined procedures. You don't have maintenance of, you know, that you continuously, consistently implement these types of programs. So as a result of that, you see that in a number, for example, Hugo Chavez, he has invested billions of dollars in social programs, He started these social programs in the year 2003. In the year 2008, he himself had to declare a health emergency because the health system was clearly not working. Allegedly, about half the health posts that had been created from 2003 onward were not operational, no doctors there, and you infer from that that there's a very high level of implementation problems. You see similar kinds of issues in Peru that, for example, one problem when you don't have very well-defined rules for implementation, very well-defined procedures, is you have a good amount of waste, corruption. And so corruption, not unknown in Brazil, as you read every week, you know, with the corruption scandals in Brazil, but it has been more widespread in countries like Peru under Fujimori and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. In Peru under Fujimori, already in 1992, there was evidence that aid that was coming in for social programs from Japan was being misused. And then, of course, when Fujimori had to step down in the year 2000, we found out that there was a huge network of corruption that was essentially just infiltrating the Peruvian government. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, one of his first social initiatives was the Plan Bolívar 2000 that he did in 2000 that was notorious for a high level of corruption. And in Venezuela in general, you see that according to Transparency International, under the Chavez government, the country's sort of ranking on corruption has deteriorated further. So in the year 2010, among 178 countries that Transparency International rated, Venezuela is rated as number 164, with a very, very low, I mean, with a very high level of corruption. And one of the reasons is, I mean, you have a number of reasons. One is kind of not much accountability at the national level, huge amounts of oil money floating around, but also not very well-established procedures, not very well-established institutions, not very much accountability in these types of economic and social programs. I was telling you, implementation problems. I was telling you about Chavez's health emergency. He also created a program of subsidized housing, and that is like way, way, way behind schedule. You know, he wanted to build, I forgot, like 2 million houses, and there are like 120,000 have been built in the last 10 years. And so, you know, you see again, big announcement, but the implementation, the actual carrying out these kinds of goals, is rather deficient. Now, clearly, implementation problems aren't unheard of in Chile and especially in Brazil, but comparatively speaking, there has been more effort to ensure implementation and to work on that through institutional rules, through standard operating procedures. And so you see, for example, my wife's research on this family grant program. I mean, even in like small towns in the interior, there's some effort of actually implementing this and some effort, the type of program we call it conditional cash transfer. So if you are a mother of kids, you get money if your kids go to school and get vaccinations. And so there's some monitoring involved. You have to make sure that, you know, the teachers actually know who shows up in school. You have to make sure that they get their polio and whatever shots. And so, I mean, even in settings that are not propitious for implementing these types of programs, there seems to be a reasonable effort being done of actually checking up and making sure that all of that happens. You see similar things in the Chilean case, like I was telling you about the health program that Concertación, that center-left coalition did in the early 2000s. There was a clear effort to make sure that the diseases covered could actually be, the treatment could be provided, that this was done in a reasonable way, not just a big announcement and then not much fulfillment afterwards. Then the last point that is also very important is that you see in these populist social programs, you see problems of financial and institutional sustainability. One thing is that these populist leaders often create social programs based on temporary revenue flows. So like Fujimori, one thing that he used for his social programs for privatization revenues. So you sell off the state oil company, you get, you know, $2 billion, you invest it in the social program. But of course, that's not a permanent revenue flow. You create a social program based on a temporary influx of money, and then the question is, how do you sustain this in the medium and long run? And that's a real problem. that is clearly one of the major problems with Hugo Chavez's social policy programs, because they have been financed very clearly out of oil revenues. The state oil company has had to hand over a whole bunch of its profits for these social programs. And these social programs have been funded to a considerable extent in a rather non-transparent way. Nobody knows how many millions and billions of dollars went into this, you know, where it actually comes from, where it actually goes, whether it's sustainable at all. And you see, for example, in 2008, 2009, when the oil price suddenly came down a lot, a number of these social programs suddenly had like budget cuts of 50%, 60% in 1 year because they were so dependent on the high oil prices that had pertained in the years before. And so you see, this is not a solid foundation. The social programs that the center-left coalition in Chile did, they're always based on tax revenues on a very solid financial basis. Or they based it on the kind of saved income of their own copper exports. But what Chile does, Chile is also a commodity exporter of copper, but they have a very firm institution that makes sure that windfall profits are saved and kept and not just spent as soon as they come in. Chavez had a similar institution, but he took it over and essentially undermined the kind of, you know, saving in the fat years to have money in the lean years. And so you see that in the Chilean government, the financial foundation for social programs is much firmer and much more solid. In Brazil, they've tried to do the same thing, that programs are funded out of permanent revenues and not out of temporary revenues. So, and then one last thing about the institutional sustainability. The social programs of these populist presidents are very much associated with their personalistic leadership. Like that school building program that I told you about that Fujimori did. As soon as Fujimori went out of office, that was just, you know, acronym on paper. It didn't exist anymore because it was so associated with Fujimori. The populist leader leaves, the program essentially folds or turns into a formality. The social programs of Chavez in Venezuela are also very much tied to his personality. You know, when he dies, if he really is as sick as people think, or if he were voted out of office, the sustainability of these programs is very doubtful because they're so kind of identified with that person. And that's not the case in the social programs created in Brazil and Chile. For example, in Chile, you had a change in government. A new president took over, coming from the center-right. But in the campaign already, he had to pledge to maintain the social policies instituted before, and he has continued to add, for example, in that health program that I told you about, he has continued to kind of expand that health program on schedule, not like, you know, this is identified with the previous government, I'm going to do something else. And so there's more institutional continuity. And as I told you, in social policy, the important thing is not so much do you create a program and do you allocate money, because a lot of money doesn't really reach its intended beneficiaries, but how do you implement it? How do you maintain it? How do you make it solid and sustainable? And so as a result of that, what I'm saying ultimately in terms of the balance sheet, yes, populist social policy has some advantages, quick action, massive initiatives, a disproportionate focus on poorer people. But I think the disadvantages outweigh that. Design flaws, politicization, implementation problems, questionable financial sustainability, problematic political and institutional sustainability. And so what I think then in the end, populist social policy is not the solution for the poverty inequality we see in Latin America. The reformist gradual path, it's not satisfying, it's not great, it's not wonderful, it's way less successful and way less promising than European social democracy. But I think for the Latin American conditions, I think it holds in the medium and long run more promise than the more volatile, the more agency-driven social policies of populists. And you see, for example, in Chile, Hugo Chavez, in the beginning of his government, poverty went up because there was an economic crisis, then poverty went down due to the oil boom. You know, poverty, if the oil boom were over, would go up again. In Chile, for example, despite economic bombs, poverty went down very, very continuously in the course of 20 years. 2009 was the first year in the crisis of 2009 that poverty went up a little, but you see a much more kind of sustainable trend, an achievement that isn't dependent on economic conjuncture, that isn't volatile, but where you see a real kind of stepwise progress that seems to be sustainable in the long run. So that's essentially what I wanted to present to you today. Thank you.